Hello, and welcome to The Report, a companion podcast to The Report, a movie starring Adam Driver, Annette Bening, and John Hamm. As always, I am joined by Daniel Jones, who was the lead investigator and author of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on the CIA's torture program.
Hi, I'm Daniel Jones. It's good to be here.
If you're new to the show, I highly recommend going back and starting with episode one. Things will make a lot more sense if you do that. And I want to start this episode by playing a clip from the movie. This is a scene where representatives from the CIA are meeting with attorneys at the Department of Justice, and they're basically working on a legal defense that they can use to prevent CIA interrogators from ever being convicted of crimes related to torture.
So here's where we're at. The crime of torture, as described in Section 2340, requires that the defendant, in this case, an interrogator, intends to cause severe pain or suffering. But in this case, that's not the interrogator's intent.
Right, the intent is to gain intel, save American lives.
But John, what if the techniques the interrogator employs do nonetheless cause pain and suffering? How do we deal with that?
Well, the key phrase is severe pain or suffering. But 2340 never actually defines the term severe. We found this definition in a Medicare statute. Severe pain or suffering. Acute symptoms that place the individual in serious jeopardy and are hard to endure.
Meaning?
To constitute torture, the damage done must rise to the level of organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or death.
So basically, if someone dies, we're doing it wrong.
If the president deemed it necessary to crush the testicles of a child to stop a plane from crashing into a building to save American lives, there is no law or treaty that could stop him. I can make the same argument for gouging out a prisoner's eyes or dousing him with acid. In our opinion, if it provides unique intelligence that saves lives and doesn't cause any lasting harm, then it's legal for the president to order it.
What do we mean when we say unique?
Intelligence that couldn't have been obtained any other way.
And you've discussed all of this with the White House, I assume.
Daniel, one of the things you found in your investigation was this thing called the necessity defense. This was one of the ways that the CIA legally justified torture. And it was based on this idea of effectiveness. Can you explain what their argument was?
The argument is that we are engaging in activity that would otherwise be illegal. But it's legal because we need this to defend the country, that these enhanced interrogation techniques produce unique information that CIA, in fact, the U.S. government, cannot obtain any other way, right? We can only get this information by waterboarding. And our defense for engaging in torture is that it was necessary to save lives, and that these techniques lead to the capture of active terrorists and the disruption of active terrorist plots. And all of that was wrong.
Why was all of this coming from the CIA when they were the ones who in the past had come to the conclusion that torture was ineffective?
Well, one of the things about the agency is so many of their internal reviews and conclusions are classified and compartmented. But that doesn't excuse their behavior. The U.S. military feels very strongly that torture produces false answers. This is like an open and shut book. It continues to be something that's pervasive around the world, this idea that torture works. But if you talk to anybody who actually knows anything about interrogation, they'll tell you it produces false answers and inaccurate intelligence.
And what was the CIA saying to the Department of Justice, to the White House, to Congress, and to all of us about how effective torture was?
Well, the entire volume two of the full 7,000-page classified report looks at just this very question. What was the CIA telling its superiors in the White House and the Department of Justice and Congress about this program, including the effectiveness? And they were saying that we need this program. It's necessary to thwart plots and capture specific terrorists. And they provided examples. We looked in the report at the 20 most prominent examples, right? What do you see in CIA briefings to the White House over and over again? What are the plots mentioned? Who are the people that were captured because of enhanced interrogation techniques? And first, we set out just to confirm that what the CIA said was accurate. And in all those 20 cases, every one of those 20 cases were fundamentally flawed in key ways, and it showed that enhanced interrogation techniques, in fact, did not lead to that capture or the thwarting of this plot.
So over the course of your investigation, you were able to confirm that torturing people did not work, right? That it did not provide the intelligence that the CIA claimed it did. How did you come to that conclusion?
We had 6.3 million pages of the CIA's classified records. And first, we set out to confirm what the CIA was claiming about the thwarting of these plots was true. We went case by case, the Karachi plot, the second wave plot, the dirty bomb plot. In total, we looked at 20 of the most frequently cited successes that the CIA attributed to torture. We reviewed every document in the CIA's holdings on these plots, right? And we identified how the CIA learned of these plots, and if it was a real plot, how it was actually thwarted. In all 20 cases, we found that the information acquired during or after torture played no significant role in the thwarting of the plot. And the CIA's representations were just plain wrong. And we were able to document how the intelligence that thwarted the plots was actually acquired and how it had nothing to do with the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques.
And later, the CIA made an effort to connect the killing of Osama bin Laden with intelligence that was gathered by torturing detainees. But you discovered that was also not true, right?
Right. This is an incredible story. The operation that led to bin Laden's death happened in May of 2011. And this was an exceptionally compartmented operation. Maybe 100 people in the U.S. government knew about the program, probably far less. But in March of 2011, many months before the operation, the CIA brought in their public affairs shop. And one of the main objectives of the public affairs shop was to connect this detention and interrogation program to the operation that eventually led to bin Laden's death. And right after the bin Laden operation, the CIA and former CIA officers were claiming that without the enhanced interrogation program, without waterboarding, the operation that led to bin Laden's death never would have happened. The former Attorney General Michael Mukasey wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that said KSM broke like a dam after waterboarding, and that he then provided information on an individual named Abu Akhmed al-Kuwaiti, which is the courier that led to bin Laden. It was all false. Before the CIA even had an enhanced interrogation program, they were targeting this courier, Abu Akhmed al-Kuwaiti. For example, in 2002, they were tracking his phones, they were tracking his emails, they had intelligence from overseas unrelated to the program, that he was engaged in attack plotting against the United States with KSM. So they were all over this guy long before the enhanced interrogation program began. And then, of course, Michael Hayden went on television and said the original lead information to Abu Akhmed al-Kuwaiti came from enhanced interrogation techniques. And again, that was all wrong. The CIA had tons of information on Abu Akhmed al-Kuwaiti long before they even had a program. So while this operation is becoming public and bin Laden's death is announced, CIA officers are immediately hitting the airwaves, talking about not bin Laden's death and his operation, what that means. They're talking about how enhanced interrogations, how their torture techniques were responsible for bin Laden's death. This goes back to the very early legal discussions that were happening in the CIA, which is if we can prove to Americans and the world that torture resulted in specific information that saved lives, people would be less likely to hold them accountable for using torture.
And that's something we are going to talk about later in the show, a sort of rundown of where are they now with a lot of the people who were involved in the CIA torture program. But right now, I want to rewind a little bit to this thing called the Memorandum of Notification. When we're talking about the legal systems that enabled the CIA torture program, this is the document that really sets the whole thing in motion, right?
Absolutely. This Memorandum of Notification from September of 17th, right after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, gave the CIA the authority to detain suspected terrorists. It said nothing about interrogation. The idea is right after September 11th, they think there's another attack coming. And they don't want to be able to say, okay, we found person X and person Y, but we don't have criminal charges against them, and we can't detain them legally. So what we want to do is take them, as the CIA would say, off the battlefield and detain them somewhere. The original theory is that you hold them until you can build criminal charges, and then you bring them back into the justice system. Of course, that never happened. And one of the reasons it didn't happen is because of torture.
It also puts the CIA into new territory. And prior to this, the CIA isn't really in the business of capturing people, right?
Absolutely. This was a new thing. The CIA never had the authority to detain individuals. They don't run prisons. This was new to them.
And so what was the significance of this memorandum?
Yeah, so the CIA, prior to this memorandum, did not have any authorities to detain individuals. And it was that memorandum giving them a covert, lawful approval to go detain suspected terrorists that resulted in this program that eventually numbered at least 119 CIA detainees.
So after the CIA gets this approval, it starts paying foreign governments to let them set up these secret prisons around the world. And this is where Mitchell and Jessen, the two psychologists, show up and start using what they call enhanced interrogation techniques on prisoners. This included waterboarding, beatings, sleep deprivation, rectal feedings and rectal hydrations, and this long list of other horrific tactics. And even from the beginning, it's clear to everyone that these techniques clearly fall under the definition of torture by the Geneva Convention, which is why you have the use of the term enhanced interrogation techniques. But at the same time, the CIA recognized that it was essentially torture. And if the agency went ahead with the program, it would need some kind of legal justification for that. Basically, a torture defense. I would like to bring in Catherine Hawkins. She's an investigator for the Project on Government Oversight, and she represented some of the detainees who were tortured at Abu Ghraib.
By the time the CIA took its first detainee into its own custody, as opposed to rendering them to torture overseas, the Bush administration had already decided that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply to the conflict of al-Qaeda. There was still the federal torture statute. And the CIA was obviously contemplating methods that would run afoul of the torture statute. And so in July 2002, I believe it was, a lawyer for the CIA's Counterterrorism Center raised the idea of asking DOJ for an advanced declination of prosecution.
And this declination of prosecution is basically a piece of paper that says, we, the Department of Justice, will not prosecute you for the crimes of torture. But ultimately, the DOJ decides not to give the CIA this document. But later, an attorney at the DOJ named John Yoo writes his own memo. This later comes to be known as the torture memo, which basically says that if the interrogators do not cause permanent damage to detainees, it's not torture.
So one of the things they do is they read the terms of the torture statute very narrowly, and they say it doesn't count as torture unless it's specifically intended to inflict severe harm. And, you know, they define that as consistent with death or organ failure. But they have other options, too, especially in the classified memo about Abu Zubaydah. They make a lot of factual representations about who he is in al-Qaeda, and they talk about how they have reason to believe that he has unique intelligence and that only these methods will work against him and that he won't suffer any lasting harm because of this psychological profile that the SEER psychologists had done of him. There's also a section on the necessity defense saying that if torture saved lives, it wasn't really torture. And there is the argument that it would be unconstitutional for Congress to outlaw torture if the president needed to use it as commander-in-chief.
Back when this idea of enhanced interrogation was first brought up to Robert Mueller, who then was the head of the FBI, he expressed concern that if the U.S. went down this road, it would cause great harm to our standing in the world, and it would make it incredibly difficult to prosecute any of the prisoners. And those concerns have turned out to be true. None of the people who were responsible for the 9/11 attacks have ever gone to trial, and in part because of the shaky legal foundations of the program and the necessity to keep it secret.
a lot of what I know about the program, I could not say without risking prosecution if I had a security clearance. And one of the things that does is it prevents not only any accountability at the CIA, but it has prevented the September 11th cases from ever going to trial because the CIA has prioritized cover-up of the torture that the defendants were subjected to over allowing the cases to go forward.
Despite the extreme secrecy around the CIA torture program over time, things started to leak out. And by 2007, the public had seen images of the abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, and President George Bush had acknowledged the use of secret prisons and enhanced interrogation techniques. The Iraq War was entering its fourth year at that point, and U.S. troops were still fighting in Afghanistan. Americans were starting to have doubts about the war on terror and these endless campaigns in the region. And this became a central issue during the 2008 presidential election. Then-candidate Barack Obama said on the campaign trail that if he became president, he would shut down the CIA's torture program.
It was something that he brought up often, this idea that America doesn't do this. So he had very clearly signaled that he was, if elected president, would shut all this down.
Mark Mazzetti is an investigative reporter for The New York Times in Washington and has spent the last 18 years covering national security.
But after his election and before he actually takes office in January of 2009, there is this effort by the CIA to convince the new team that they had been sold a bill of goods about the CIA program. And in fact, it was far more effective than they had heard, and they'd been fed a lot of misinformation. So Mike Hayden, who actually, you know, still I think thought he had a chance of being Obama's CIA director, that Obama might keep him on, is trying to tell Dennis McDonough and others on the Obama team that they should keep this program because they're going to need it down the road. And don't be so hasty because everyone will soon forget what you pledged during the campaign, but, you know, you might want this program down the road. Now, of course, that doesn't happen. It's one of Obama's first acts, shuts down the program. So that was Obama carrying through on his campaign pledge, but that didn't end the problem for Obama. You know, just the fact that he had said, we're shutting this down, we will never do this again, then created this real tension and ongoing controversy about, well, what do we do about the past?
The big question was, how would the Obama administration investigate this program? And what was going to happen to the people who tortured detainees? And at this point, there were a few options. One was to create a commission modeled after the 9/11 commission. Creating an independent commission like this would have shown that the U.S. government was serious about learning the truth about the program and about taking the necessary steps to ensure that torturers or people who approve torture would be held accountable.
Right. So Obama basically shuts down this idea that there's going to be a full independent commission going back and examining the history of the CIA program. You know, he had shut down the program, he had released the memos, but felt that dredging up things that he had said were, you know, in the past and didn't need to be dredged up would serve no good. And really tried to, actively, his administration tried to actively, you know, keep any kind of 9/11 type commission from starting. So they basically left it to the Senate to do its investigation. They can't stop that from happening, but they could apply pressure to keep another type of commission from going on. Again, this is, pretty early on in the Obama administration, we get a sense of how Obama wants to, you know, carry out the types of wars, you know, that Bush had begun. You know, Obama campaigned on getting out of Iraq, called the Iraq War a disaster. But he's during the campaign, he certainly indicated that he was okay with the drone program. What he does is he picks up where Bush left off on the drone program, where he kind of embraces, certainly from the first year and a half of his term, embraces this dramatic escalation of drone strikes. So he really is relying on the CIA to carry out the shadow wars, even as he's publicly trying to get out of the big costly wars like the war in Iraq, he's empowered Leon Panetta, the CIA director, to carry out a critical aspect of his foreign policy.
And just to rewind a bit, one of the things that happened around the time of the creation of the CIA drone program during the Bush administration was the release of that internal report by the CIA on the effectiveness of the torture program.
So if you go back to the Helgerson report, I think it was May of 2004, that's the date on the report when it was delivered around to different departments in the Bush administration. And the next month is the very first CIA drone strike in Pakistan. Now, I don't want to say one dramatically led to the other, that everyone got around and said, you know, we can't do these methods anymore. They're too controversial. So let's just start killing people. However, if you look at the arc of what happens in CIA tactics, they stop waterboarding. They stop some of the most extreme methods, and they recognize, because in large part, I'd say initially because of the Helgerson report, that they're going to have to get out of the detention interrogation business because it's a mess and it's only blowing back on them. And what happens then? You have starting a lethal drone campaign primarily in Pakistan, but also in Yemen and in Somalia, that this is really the history of the latter part of the Bush administration and into the Obama administration. This is the CIA tactics, which is identify people and kill them rather than identify people, capture and interrogate them. And this is something that certainly had great congressional buy-in, the drone program. And it was seen as something that was effective, but it was also seen as less politically risky. And so I think that's an important point to make about how the CIA shifts tactics, and tactics that are then embraced by the new administration once Obama comes in.
Next time on The Report, the story of a document that was supposed to be kept secret, but ultimately ended up in the hands of Daniel Jones, who, as soon as he saw it, recognized that if the Senate or the public saw what it said, it would completely demolish the CIA's defense of the torture program. Amazon Studios' The Report is produced by Topic Studios and Western Sound. Executive producers for Topic Studios are Maria Zuckerman, Letal Molad, and Lisa Limegang. Special thanks to Lizzie Jacobs. Executive producer for Western Sound is Ben Adair, and the producer is David Weinberg. Hannes Brown composed original music and mixed the show. Daniel Jones is executive producer and host. I'm Kelly McEvers. Thanks for listening.